Good morning, each one. So, yeah, I guess you're going to be hearing a little bit more about some aspect of me, of life. So, this morning I've chosen to talk about disappointment with God. It's was one of the, by Philip Yancey, one of the required reading. Each of the three sessions of life, there was three books, and this, for the last one here, this is one of the required reading. So I've found these books. These aren't necessarily novels. They aren't page turners, but it's been really good. And Yancey would have co-written that book, Gift of Pain, that Jason spoke on, or you were with Dr. Brand, So I think Yancey's got a lot of good things to say. And yeah, I'm heading down on Wednesday, so I would cover your prayers for Thursday to Saturday. It's been, very life-changing. It's been very life-changing for me to be down there and just getting counseled. Like, it's, I was thinking I should be doing what Randall's doing, and in some ways I'm jealous of him, but I think it's, it is actually happening. As you're involved in Core One, you actually are getting counseled, so it's just, it's amazing. So three questions that he poses is God unfair? Is God silent? And is God hidden? And thinking about disappointment, we should maybe define it a bit and try to figure out, why would Christians be disappointed with God at times? Googled it, and it says, sadness or displeasure caused by non-fulfillment of one's hopes or expectations. In the book, Yancey said this: true atheists do not, I presume, feel disappointed in God. They expect nothing and receive nothing. But those who commit their lives to God, no matter what, instinctively expect something in return. Are those expectations wrong? So, in chapter 2, it is entitled Up in Smoke. Philip Yancey, he talks about an encounter with a guy named Richard. And Richard was a theology student at Wheaton College, a graduate school. And he contacted Yancey. He must have felt a kinship because of some of Yancey's writings. And so he had written a paper on Job, which his professor thought, should make a book out of it. And so this Richard guy asked Philip if he would look at it. And so Philip said yes, and the manuscript soon arrived. And he stated he wasn't necessarily expecting a whole lot because he felt that, graduate school papers don't necessarily or normally make compelling reading. But he was wrong, and Richard's work showed some real promise. So I'll read a little bit here. A year later, with a finished manuscript and signed contract in hand, Richard called to ask if I would write a foreword. I still had never met Richard, but I liked his enthusiasm, and he had written a book I could easily endorse. 6 months passed, during which the book went through final editing and revision, and shortly before the publication date, Richard called yet again. His voice sounded different, tense, edgy. To my surprise, he fended off questions about his forthcoming book. "I need to see you, Philip," he said. "There's something I feel obligated to tell you, and it should be in person. Could I come over some afternoon this week?" And he came in. He skipped the small talk. "You've got a right to be furious with me," he began. "I don't blame you a bit for feeling snookered." I had no idea what he meant. "About what?" "Well, it's like this. The book you helped me with, it's coming out next week, including your foreword. But the truth is, I don't believe what I wrote in that book anymore. I feel I owe you an explanation." He paused for a moment, and I watched the lines of tension working in his jaw. "I hate God," he suddenly blurted out. "No, I don't mean that. I don't even believe in God." And so then Richard talked with Yancey for a long time, and stuff had happened in his life. I think his parents had went through a divorce, and maybe a romance thing went south, and just different stuff. And all this to say, one night he decided to take his Bible. Books and went out to the fire pit or whatever and burnt them until a fireman showed up and put it out, and thus the chapter called Up in Smoke. And I think thinking about this and some other situations made Bill think about these questions. So he pulled up in Colorado in a cabin and went to ponder these questions. And this is what he said: For 2 weeks, I holed up in Colorado cabin to ponder Richard's three questions in light of what I'd seen in the Old Testament. I brought along a suitcase full of books to study, but during my entire time there, I opened only a Bible. I started in Genesis late the first afternoon, a day of heavy snowfall. It was a perfect setting for reading the story of creation. Clouds lifted in time for a spectacular alpenglow sunset, with puffs of snow pulling off the tops of the mountain peaks like cotton candy. At night, the clouds closed in again, and snow blew furiously. I read straight through the Bible, slowly, cover to cover. By the time I reached Deuteronomy, snow covered the bottom step. When I hit the prophets, it had crept up to the mailbox post. And when I finally made it to Revelation, I had a call for a snowplow to unbury the driveway. Over 72 inches of fresh powder fell during the 2 weeks I spent reading the Bible and looking out the window, the sugar-coated evergreens. It struck me forcefully there that our common impressions of God may be very different from the God the Bible actually portrays. And so then thinking about the Old Testament, there's a chapter called The Parent, and essentially the God's very creation disobeys and rebels on him. And we see that in Genesis 6:6, the Lord regretted that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. And I think we as parents can actually, feel that pang of remorse as well when we have a child that rebels or walks away. But think of it for God. It wasn't just one child. It was his entire creation. And thinking about Abraham, we see that God was yearning for faith. And Abraham, in his life, he didn't see all the descendants that were promised, but he did see Isaac. And what about Joseph? If anyone had valid reason to be disappointed with God, it was Joseph, whose valiant stabs at goodness brought him nothing but trouble. He interpreted a dream to his brothers, and they threw him in a cistern. He resisted a sexual advance and landed in Egyptian prison. He interpreted another dream to save his cellmate's life, and his cellmate promptly forgot about him. I wonder, as Joseph languished for his virtue in an Egyptian dungeon, did questions like Richard's, "Is God fair, unfair, silent, hidden," ever occur to him? And then there's a chapter called Great Expectations, and he explores that when Jesus was on earth and walking with men, that disappointment didn't necessarily vanish, nor has it till this day, as I'm sure all of us can testify. And let's read in John 5. John 5, starting at verse 1. After this, there was a feast of the Jews, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. Now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, an Aramaic called Bethesda, which has roof colonnades. In these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. One man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, "Do you want to be healed?" The sick man answered him, "Sir, I have no one to put me in the pool when the water is stirred up. And while I'm going there, another steps down before me." Jesus said, "Get up, take up your bed and walk." And at once the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked. Now that day was the Sabbath, so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, "Is it the Sabbath, and is it not lawful for you to take up your bed?" But he answered them, "The man who healed me, that man said to me, 'Take up your bed and walk.'" They asked him, "Who is the man who said to you, 'Take up your bed and walk'?" Now the man who had been healed did not know who it was, for Jesus had withdrawn, and there was a crowd in the place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, "See, you are well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you." The man went away and told Jesus that it was Jesus who had healed him. And this is why the Jews were persecuting Jesus, because he was doing these things in the Sabbath. But Jesus answered them, "My Father is working until now, and I am working." So, I don't know if this story has ever caused questions in any of your mind about fairness and why just this man. I think back on my life I may have thought of it and puzzled over it, but this has definitely Yancey brings it out. This has definitely caused a problem for some people, and like a great theologian like Augustine has puzzled, you know. Puzzled over this. Why just the one? But it's a chapter called the Divine Shyness, or you could also be classified as maybe Divine Restraint. And because I think you and I have probably have times that we would like, "God, why don't you show yourself?" Like, you know, if God did something, you know, amazing or some miracle, then for sure we'd believe. But we have to ask ourselves, so what did Jesus actually come to do? He wanted relationships, and he wasn't here just to show off his power. And something that it says towards the end of the book that I really like is, goes like this: "If we insist on visible proofs from God, we may well prepare ourselves for a permanent state of disappointment. True faith does not so much attempt to manipulate God to do our will as it does to position us to do his will." And thinking about what he says about the Holy Spirit, it's sobering to think that that we as Christians hold some of the answers to the questions that are probably wrestled with in this book. Because when people are searching, it may be you or I, it may be you or I that they come across. And along with that, I think something we need to be honest about is that sometimes our disappointment with God actually stems from other Christians. And so let's strive to be aware of that and avoid causing fellow believers disappointment, if at all possible. And what he says is with the Holy Spirit, like, the Holy Spirit will not remove all disappointment with God. The very titles given to the Spirit, intercessor, helper, counselor, comforter, imply that there will be problems. So that's something for us to consider as well. So now back to Job. Let's read in Job 1. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. There were born to him 7 sons, 3 daughters. He possessed 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 5 female donkeys, and very many servants, so that this man was the greatest of all the people of the East. His sons used to go and hold a feast in the house, each one on his day, and they would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with him. And when the days of their feast had run their course, Job would send and consecrate them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer a burnt offering according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my children have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." Thus did Job continually. Now, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, "From going to and fro on the earth, and from walking up and down on it." And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, blameless, upright man, who fears God and turns from evil?" Then Satan answered the Lord and said, "Does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge around him and his house, that all he has on every side? You have blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will curse you to your face." And the Lord said to Satan, "Behold, all that he has is in your hand, only against him do not stretch out your hand." So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. Now there was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine at their oldest brother's house, and there came a messenger to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, and the donkeys feeding beside them, and the Sabaeans fell on them and took them, and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The fire of God fell from heaven and burnt up the sheep and the servants and consumed them, and I alone have escaped to tell you." While he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "The Chaldeans formed 3 groups and made a raid on the camels and took them and struck down the servants with the edge of the sword, and I alone have escaped to tell them." And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, a great wind came across the wilderness and struck the 4 corners of the house, and it fell upon the young people, and they are dead, and I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose, tore his robe, shaved his head, and fell to the ground and worshipped, and said, "Naked I came to from my mother's womb, and naked shall return. The Lord gave, the Lord hath taken away, blessed be the name of the Lord." In all this Job did not sin, nor charge God with wrong. Chapter 2, and again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them to present himself before the Lord. And the Lord said to Satan, "From where have you come?" Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking up and down on it. And the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, although you enticed me against him to destroy him without reason. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, skin for skin, all that a man has, he will give for his life. But stretch out your hand and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse you to your face. And the Lord said to Satan, behold, he is in your hand, only spare his life. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord and struck Job with loathsome sores from the sole of his foot to the crown of his head. And he took a piece of broken pottery, which he had scraped himself, while he sat in the ashes. Then his wife said to him, do you still hold fast your integrity? Curse God and die. But he said to her, you speak as one of the foolish women would speak. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? And all this Job did not sin with his lips. Now when Job's friends heard of all the evil that came upon him, they came each from their own place, Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Amathite. They made an appointment together to come and show him sympathy, comfort him. And when they saw him from a distance, they did not recognize him, and they raised their voices and wept. They tore their robes and sprinkled dust on their heads toward heaven, and they sat with him on the ground 7 days, 7 nights. No one spoke a word, for they saw the suffering was very great. And maybe it would have been good if they would have stayed that way, but then you wouldn't have had the rest of Job. So I think it's good thoughts for us to think about when someone's going through stuff. So Yancey would say he feels that he's misread the book of Job. Instead of thinking about it as a book of pain and suffering, he would say it's primarily about faith in its starkest form. And in reading chapter 1 and 2 there, you see that, you know, something's going on in the cosmic realm, and Satan's claiming that there's a, you know, a hedge of protection around Job, and there's not permission for him. And so a thought he has in the book, and you might not like the idea of Satan and God betting, and like we aren't really betting people, but Yancey kind of thinks he thinks it's almost something resembling a wager. It's maybe rather than looking at Job as an arm wrestling match between God and Job, maybe the contestants are actually God and Satan. And but Job's response obviously matters, and I would argue that God already knew the outcome. And what about you and I when we face stuff? Something that just read a bit here again. Very often disappointment with God begins in Job-like circumstances. The death of a child, a tragic accident, a loss of job may bring on some of the same questions Job asked. Why me? What does God have against me? Why does he seem so distant? As readers of Job's story, we can see behind the curtain to a contest being waged in the invisible world. But in our own trials, we will not have such insight. When tragedy strikes, we will live in a shadow, unaware of what is transpiring in the unseen world. The drama that Job lived through will then replace itself in our own individual lives. Once again, God will let his reputation ride on the response of unpredictable human beings. And a thought I really liked in the chapter, is God unfair? Is we need a new heaven. We need a new heaven and a new earth. And and until we have that, you know, unfairness will not disappear. And we need to live out our days on Easter Sunday. It's just kind of a cool thought. I also like how he talks about Hebrews. In Hebrews 11, we call it the heroes of faith, or the faith hall of fame. But Yancey refers to call it to the survivors of the fog. And has this ever been you? When you're going through something, you know, it seems like stuff's in a fog. And yeah, it's just something for us to keep in mind. Something else for us to keep in mind when we're going through pain too is that pain and suffering kind of tends to narrow our vision. And it's easy to focus on ourselves, but we have to remember that God's got something a whole lot bigger going on. And now, why Job died? Why Job died happy? One of the last chapters in the book is titled that, Why Job Died Happy. Let's read Job 42. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I did not know. Hear and I will speak, I will question you, and you make it known to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eyes sees you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes. After the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord said to Eliphaz the Temanite, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken of me that which is right, as my servant Job has. Now, therefore, take seven bulls and seven rams, and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves. And my servant Job shall pray for you, for I will accept his prayer, not to deal with you according to your folly, for you have not spoken to me that which is right, as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite and Bildad the Shuhite, so far the Amathite, went and did what the Lord had told them. The Lord accepted Job's prayer. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came to him all his brothers and all his sisters and all who had known him before and ate bread with him in his house. And they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. And the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than his beginning. He had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, 1,000 female donkeys. And he also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he called the name of the first daughter Jemima, and the name of the second Keziah, and the name of the third Karen Habak. And in all the land, there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters. And their father gave them an inheritance among the brothers. And after this, Job lived 140 years. And he saw his sons and his sons' sons, 4 generations, and Job died an old man full of days. So, Yancey points out in his book that some readers of Job point out, okay, like, so here's our final answer to disappointment with God. That says, oh, that God will deliver his people from adversity, and, you know, he restored Job's health and wealth, and he'll do the same for us if we trust him like Job did. But it's something we have to keep in mind, is that Job spoke his contrite, repentant words prior to his restorations, mm-hmm. if you see in verse 6, and... Job lived a long time after that. He got to And he got to hang out with his grandchildren and his greats, and I'm sure if he was a good storyteller, he would have had amazing stories to tell. But the biggest thing is that Job never gave up on God, and Satan lost. And can the same be said about you and I? This is something I thought I'd read yet, and that thinking about the Easter time, and this that we're kind of coming into here, and I think Yancey's got some good words here. Today, the major events of Jesus' life are marked on calendars around the world: Christmas, Good Friday, and Easter. Of the three, however, only the middle one, the crucifixion, took place in the open for all the world to see. At the moment when God seemed downright helpless, the cameras of history were rolling, recording it all. Large crowds watched every excruciating detail. And when four men wrote up accounts of Jesus' life, they collectively devoted one-third of their gospels to that time of apparent failure. The spectacle of the cross, the most public event of Jesus' life, reveals the vast difference between a God who proves himself through power and one who proves himself through love. Other gods, Roman gods, for example, enforced worship. In Jesus' own lifetime, some Jews were slaughtered for not bowing down to Caesar. But Jesus Christ never forced anyone to believe him. He preferred to act by appeal, drawing people out of themselves and toward him. Paradoxically, that sense of weakness inspired new hope. If God is for us, who can be against us? Concluded the Apostle Paul, resting his faith on the boundless love of God, who did not spare his own son, but gave him up for us all. Love is the most persuasive when it involves sacrifice. And the Gospels make it clear that Jesus came to die. In his own words, "Greater love hath no man than this, that one lay down his life for his friends." Somehow the possibility of eternal happiness required this time of silence and profound disappointment.